So we're going to go on where we left off in 1 Corinthians. Those of you who have not been part of this study, we're going to be beginning today a new section in the book. So I think you'll not be too far behind the rest of us. Remember, please, that the second part of 1 Corinthians, beginning in chapter 7, the Apostle Paul is dealing now with questions that were asked him by the members of that Corinthian church. In the first six chapters, he dealt with problems that were reported to him by representatives of the church. In chapter 7 and following, they had now written to him asking him about various matters that were taking place in the church, things that they did not quite understand, some disagreements among themselves as far as practice was concerned. And so the apostle is answering those questions, giving the divinely inspired apostolic answer to those questions. We, before the Christmas break, we're looking at the problems in chapters 8, 9, and 10. The question here concerned the matter of Christian liberty. And the specific illustration, the specific problem that generated this question concerned the eating of meat that was offered unto idols. And Paul did not give them a clear-cut answer. And I think in this realm of Christian liberty, that is itself an important lesson. We like many times to have the answer given to us in black and white terms, do this or don't do this, not have to take the scriptures then and evaluate the circumstances in the light of the scriptures. It's much easier if someone simply tells us do this or don't do this. And that's basically what they were wanting Paul to do. They wanted Paul to say, don't eat this meat or eat this meat, and that would settle it. Paul did not answer the question that way. His basic answer was, well, it depends. It depends whether you eat it or don't eat it. And he then developed the various circumstances whereby that problem was to be evaluated. But the bottom line was, again, the relationship that we have with Christ and the gospel. Do you understand what Christ has done to save us? Remember the spiritual condition of those that you are in fellowship with, and do not do anything to cause an offense against those who are your fellow believers. Weak though they may be, but nonetheless, do nothing that will cause an offense to your weaker brother. Now, and we spend some little time discussing and defining what that biblical offense was. Remember, please, that it is a very strong word in the New Testament scriptures. It has the idea of causing someone to sin. It's not a matter of everybody agreeing as to their personal preferences or not liking this or that. It is that which causes another brother to sin, and we take that very seriously. We so live our life not to bring any reproach to the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And he closes this, and let me just remind you of some of the things that we discussed as I remember the last time we were in this chapter, as we brought chapter 10 to a close, as he summarizes now this, and he makes a comparison. And I give you this review in view of what we are going to be doing a bit later in our services today, as he makes a comparison between the taking of the Lord's table and the taking of that meat that was offered to idols in a religious context. Now, certainly in the religious context, there was no choice that Paul was making here or Paul was giving to those Corinthian believers. In a religious context, they could not eat that meat offered unto idols because there was something very sacred about that religious practice. Those that partook of the idol meat were partakers of the idol, and they were fellowshipping with those demons, Paul says. And he makes the comparison with the Lord's Supper. Do you not know that those that take of the Lord's Supper, those that are taking of that cup of blessing, are fellowshipping, they are partaking of Christ himself. And there is a very special relationship between the eating and the drinking at the Lord's table and the spiritual fellowship and the spiritual exercise that we have in the presence of Christ. Now, I think that's something that we need to be thinking of today. We, as Protestants sometimes, in our opposition to the Roman view of the Mass, where they take this as a true experience of the body and the blood of Christ, and it becomes a transfer of efficacious grace as they take of that, and we reject that, we react against that, we argue against that from the Scriptures. But in our reaction and in our refutation of the Roman Mass, let's not, as we've been reminded on more than one occasion, to treat this supper lightly. Yes, the bread is bread, and we're going to see that in chapter 11 in greater detail. The bread is bread and the wine is wine. There's nothing magical that takes place in the elements. We're going to take bread today and we're going to take juice today. That's all it is. It's just that physical substance. But nonetheless, the Bible teaches us here that as we partake of this bread and of this cup, we are fellowshipping, we are entering into a joint relationship with Christ Himself. And there is a spiritual exercise. And there is a spiritual experience that must take place as we come to partake of the Lord's Supper. We speak of this as a sacrament. It's a term that many who don't know what words mean oppose, but it's a good word. A sacrament is a means. It is a vehicle of demonstration. Here becomes a vehicle whereby the grace of God revealed to us in Christ is demonstrated to us with visible signs, with visible pictures. And it must so speak to our hearts. And the grace of God, not saving grace. There's nothing efficacious in regard to salvation as we partake of these elements. Not at all. But there ought to be today a reception of the grace of God in our hearts as we take of that bread and of that wine. As we have our hearts focused and as Christ speaks to us and we enjoy the very presence of Christ with us, that's the grace of God. It's the grace of God. Let our eyes be open to that spiritual experience today. And that's the way Paul closes this particular argument. All right, now that brings us to the new section. In chapter 11, Paul introduces a new problem. You can see in verse 2, the key word that we have been using to identify the transition of thought. Now I praise you, brethren, that ye remember me in all things and keep the ordinances I delivered them to you, and so forth. In this chapter, there are going to be basically two problems that he deals with. Both of these are introduced, I say, by that word. You can see the next one in verse 17. Now in this that I declare unto you, I praise you not. That you come together not for the better, but for the worse. So two new problems that Paul is going to address in this 11th chapter. Both of these problems deal in the context of public worship. Now, there's little doubt as we come to the close of this chapter that the theme is that of public worship. He's dealing with the communion service. Here is a passage at verse 23 and following that we read almost every time we come to the Lord's table. It is the classic representation, the classic definition, instruction that we have in the New Testament concerning the observance of the Lord's table. And it's one that we would do well not only to read publicly as we come to the table, Sabbath by Sabbath as we celebrate the Lord's table, but one that we would do well to examine ourselves in our personal self-examination, in our personal study and preparation as we make our plans to come to the communion table. It's a very significant chapter, and I trust in due course we'll have some things to say concerning the instructions and the definitions that Paul gives of the Lord's Supper, the Lord's table, the communion service, beginning at verse 17 and following. There were abuses there, and he corrects those abuses at the Lord's table by giving a reminder and a definition to them of the true significance and the seriousness of the Lord's table. That's the second problem that he deals with, and this, I say, is in the context of public worship. We do not believe, and we would certainly warn against any private celebrations of the Lord's Supper. This is an ordinance, is a sacrament that Christ has given to the church, and it is a church responsibility. And I think the New Testament makes that clear. And certainly in Presbyterianism, it's a great theme that we emphasize, that there is. And if you read your Read your confession and your catechism, or your confession anyway on this. I don't remember if the catechism addresses it or no, but the confession certainly does concerning the celebration of the sacrament of the Lord's table. It is not a private matter. It is that which is a public act of worship on the part of the church, not to say that it has to be within the confines necessarily of a physical church building that has a duly recognized sign on the outside identifying it as a church, but it must be a public function of the church. It is not something that you do in the privacy of your homes to add to the sincerity of your home devotions or whatever, or that you do on a New Year's Eve party with your friends to give seriousness and sobriety to that which is taking place. It is the responsibility of the church. Now, I'm saying that to set the context of the first problem that he deals with as well. And I would argue and will be arguing here that this issue of the activity of worship, the praying and the prophesying and the decorum of man and woman in the place of praying and prophesying is in the context of the public worship. Now, this is a section that I have, I think, addressed with you on more than one occasion. I think one of the summer special series that we have a few years ago, I gave an exposition of 1 Corinthians chapter 11 as it deals with the matter of head covering for women and the lack of head covering for men. And I think we need to put both of those together here. We sometimes come to this passage looking just at what the requirement for women is, but there is statements here and there's instructions here that are necessary for men as well. The proper decorum and behavior in the place of public worship. Now, because I have dealt with this rather thoroughly in the past, I have a little booklet still floating around. I think they're out of stock now. We may have to get some of those redone, perhaps. But I think some of you, most of you probably have seen the little booklet that I've written on this particular issue. So you have that. And I think because of all of that, I will not have to spend a great deal of time going over all the details of this chapter. But let me remind you certainly of a couple of the issues, and I'll summarize the argument of the apostle in this section. All right. Now, the problem was, how are we to behave? How are we to look in the place of worship? In the Corinthian church, apparently there were, and we don't know exactly what the problem was. All right. We don't know exactly what the problem was, whether there were men coming into the place of worship with their head covered. That very well may have been part of the problem. And Paul is putting an end to that practice. In the Christian church, he says, men are not going to have their heads covered when worshiping. Now, that was contrary, you see. That was contrary to what was taking place in normal Jewish worship. In Jewish worship, men had their heads covered in the place of worship. And Paul is contending here that this Christian worship, the worship in the church, is distinctive from that Jewish ceremony, that Jewish practice. Men are not to have their heads covered. That was just as much part of the instruction here as the counterpart of women having their heads covered. In the Greek society, in the pagan religion that was rampant in Corinth and all of the Roman Empire, that Greek worship of the pagan deities, it was customary there for both the men and the women to have their heads uncovered in the place of worship. That was the custom of the day. In the pagan worship, the custom was men and women alike had heads that were uncovered in the place of worship. In the Jewish circles, men were to have their heads covered. But now we have instructions here that were given to the Christian church. And there were some distinctives that were given to the Christian church that marked it, visibly marked it, as being different from the Jewish worship and the Greek or Roman pagan worship that surrounded the early Christian church. Now, I'm saying that up front to dispel the idea that what Paul is talking about here in this chapter is simply a matter of custom. You see, that it's simply it was the custom. This is one of the arguments that we often hear in regard to this chapter. It was simply the custom of the Corinthian people, of the Corinthian church, to have the women's head covered and the men's head uncovered in the place of worship. It was simply a matter of custom. Customs change. And therefore, this is no longer appropriate for us. But the point is, it was not the custom, you see. It was not the custom in that Corinthian society to follow the outline and the instructions that Paul is giving in this chapter. It was contrary to custom. It was contrary to custom. And it is that, therefore, that is not in any way related to fashion trends. It is not that which in any way is related to matters of preference. Here are instructions that Paul gives. Now, I say I don't know exactly what the problem was in the Corinthian church, but Paul deals with it from both perspectives of what is appropriate for the man and what is appropriate for the woman. Now, there are basically, and let me review this with you very quickly, there are basically two interpretations of this matter of head covering in the place of worship from 1 Corinthians chapter 11. You have one view that identifies the head covering as the hair. And the key verse for this interpretation is going to be verse 15. But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. Now, that's stated very explicitly there. The hair is given for a covering. So on the basis of that statement, the basis of that verse, we have a very common interpretation of this passage, that the head covering referred to all the way through the passage is simply the hair. So long as a woman has hair on her head in the place of worship, that is what Paul is concerned about, because the hair is given for a covering. Now, I'll have some more to say about that perhaps as we go through some of the specifics. There's interesting changes in words here. I'll comment on the word covering there in verse 15. That is not the word that is used in the earlier portion of the chapter. I'll say some things about that perhaps in a moment. But that's one interpretation, that the head covering is to be identified as the hair. The second interpretation is that the head covering is something extra that was to be placed upon the head. A man was not to have that extra something upon the head. A woman was to have that something extra upon the head in the place of worship. Now, from an exegetical standpoint, an expositional standpoint, I think the text lends itself to that interpretation. And most of the, what can I say? I don't know what to say here. Most of those that see it my way obviously take it that way. Most of those that have any sense see it that way. From a purely exegetical standpoint, this, I think, is the standard interpretation. All right, from a purely exegetical standpoint, this is the standard interpretation, that the head covering that Paul deals with in this chapter is something that is extra placed upon the head. Simply from the reading of the text, that, I think, is going to be clear. Now, with that second interpretation, I saw my hand out like that and I brought it back. I preached up there. They had, what do you call these things on New Year's Eve? What? Watch night service, yes. A watch night service. I preached that, started preaching at 11:15. Boys, talk about pressure to be finished by the new year. That was tough. But anyway, when am I saying this? Oh, I saw my hand that reminded me. My dad was there, and he videoed me during this. And do you show? Bruce is right. I thought I was looking at Bruce up there. It was terrible. When I bring that back, that's, I've lost my train of thought now. The interpretation that sees this as head covering, all right, something extra. Those that hold that exegetical interpretation then are going to do two things with the passage. All right, you have those that will argue then that because the text says this, it applies to the day in which we live. All right, it applies to the day in which we live. Second, they're going to say, yes, that's what the scripture is saying here. That's what the text is saying. But it does not apply to the day in which we live. All right, now that basically, then you have three options. Basically three options as to how to take this text. Number one, the head covering is hair. If you have hair, you're obedient to the passage. Number two, that it does refer to something extra. Now it either applies or it doesn't apply. Those that say it doesn't apply say that was simply a matter of custom in the Corinthian era, in the early Greek church, in the early Roman church, rather, and therefore no longer applicable to us. Well, we'll see, I trust, as we go through the passage very quickly, what is really involved here. I think my interpretation is, if you've read the little booklet and whatever, is clear enough. But let me try to explain where I'm going. All right, I want to begin here. I want to begin by looking at the authority with which Paul addresses this issue. Look at the authority. There are certain things that Paul does not give, and we've seen that in the preceding chapters. There have been those instances where Paul does not give a black and white response to one of these problems. He says it depends upon this, upon that, upon whatever. But here he gives a very authoritative word as he deals with this issue. Notice the language of verse 2. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and so forth. Now, as he deals with this issue, he identifies this context with the term the ordinances, and he praises them for having kept the ordinances that he had delivered unto them. Now, let me define this word ordinance. We sometimes use this word ordinance in our church vocabulary to refer to baptism and the Lord's Supper. Here are the ordinances of the church, and that's good. That's a good use of the word. But that is not the implication of this word. This word ordinance is not used in the New Testament to refer to baptism or the Lord's Supper as that which was instituted by Christ as a practice of the church. It's a word that is sometimes translated, if I recall correctly, as tradition. It's the word that is translated tradition. You have kept the traditions that I have given you. But even that word in English creates a false connotation. We think of tradition as something that is simply passed on from generation to generation, something that becomes part of our practice because our fathers did it and their fathers did it, and it's just passed on and becomes a matter of our heritage. But that's not the significance of this word either, although it's sometimes translated in that way in the Authorized Version. The basic idea of this word is something that has been received. It is that which has been received, that which has been received and there and then given. It is a word that is very often associated with the apostolic message, a word associated with the apostolic message. Paul is speaking here of their keeping that which, number one, he had received by revelation from God. It is a term that smacks of revelation. It involves the apostolic revelation that Christ had given to Paul as the apostle. Here is that which was revealed to Paul, and then as the apostle, as the spokesman of Christ now to man, he gives that word unto the people. Becomes part of the proclamation. It is the apostolic word. It is a word, therefore, that is filled with authority. It is an authoritative word. That divinely revealed truth. This was not his own idea. He was not simply reminding them of local practice or local custom, but he is setting forth that which was specifically and directly revealed unto him. Here is an apostolic word. Now, he praises them to begin with for having kept all of these things. And it's not without significance that immediately following this reference to these divinely revealed truths, he now deals with this matter of the practice of head covering. It is not simply an issue that he is going to discuss by recommendation. what he says here is put under the apostolic authority. Here is that which Christ has revealed. The order of worship, the way of worship. This ought not be difficult for us to understand, particularly as Presbyterians. We have our confession. And you remember in our study of the confession in those early chapters that deal with the matter of worship, we learn that God is concerned not only with who we worship, right? God is not concerned only with who we worship, but he does not leave the how of worship to our imaginations. God reveals to us how we are to properly worship him. In the preliminary exercises in your catechism, you've been going over the Ten Commandments. The first commandment identifies what? It's the first commandment identifies who we are to worship. Who we are to worship. Commandment number 2, 3, and 4, while they have various implications, basically can be summarized in this way. They are telling us how to worship. See? Who to worship? How to worship? Sabbath day. Does God have a right to tell his people how to worship him? Yes, he does. He demands that exclusive worship. He demands exclusive allegiance unto him as a person. There's the who. But he also has a right, and he takes that right, and he exercises that prerogative all the way through the scripture to tell us how we are to worship. Now, we come to this matter of even the decorum of man and woman in the place of public worship. Does God have a right to tell a man not to have something on his head and a woman to have something on it? Does God have that right? Well, yes, he has that right. The how of worship is defined for us in the scripture just as much as the who of worship. Now, authority, authority. If we look at the end of this chapter, the end of this section, we have here a particular literary device that we call inclusio, where the passage begins sometimes with the same word, ends with the same word, or a similar theme. Here it ends, I think, and begins with the same theme, begins with that statement of apostolic authority, and it ends with that statement of apostolic authority. Look at verse 16. But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. Now, look at the implications of what Paul is saying here. He is saying that he will not tolerate contentiousness in regard to this issue that has been discussed between verses 3 and verse 50. We're not going to argue about this, he says. We're not going to be contentious about this. This is not a matter of discussion. I'm not putting this up for a matter of debate. There will be no contention. There will be no argumentation. Intolerant he is here concerning their reaction to what he has just declared. Now, he says, we don't have a custom. We don't have a custom that, and I've lost my place. We have no such custom, neither the churches of God. You can see that's plural, just by the way, which the churches here is not talking just about the Corinthian church, not just a local custom in Corinth that was the issue here, but here is a widespread statement that Paul links with all of the New Testament churches. We don't have this practice. Now, what was the practice that we don't have and that we're not going to tolerate? What was the practice? The practice of men coming into the church with heads covered is a practice that we are not going to tolerate. We don't have that. None of the churches have it. The practice of women coming into the church with heads uncovered is something that does not take place in any of the Christian churches. And we're not going to argue about it. Very authoritative. You see. Very authoritative is the word that Paul gives here in this particular issue. We're not going to argue about it. Not going to leave it up to option. Should we eat meat offered to idols? It depends. It depends. What about this? It doesn't depend. Here's the apostolic word. Here's the divinely inspired word. Here is the authoritative word that defines the regulation. Now, I read that language. And I have to be impressed with the intense emphasis that Paul is placing here upon the authority of the message. And it seems very unlikely to me that I can now come to this passage having started with the word of authority, ending with this word of apostolic authority, to say now that the application of this passage for us is take it or leave it. See, I have a hard time seeing that. That having gone through the intricacy of argument that we'll see here, that he comes to the final statement and says, now having given you this word, which is apostolic, which is the practice in all of our churches, now as far as you're concerned, you know, do what you want. The whole argument goes out the window. We have all these verses ultimately then that are wasted. If Paul comes to the conclusion and says, now do what you want, he's not giving them the right to do what they want in this regard. It was a matter of their obedience. Well, my time is gone for today. I've set this up for you. We'll take some time next week, Lord willing, to follow the argument and remind you of some of the specific interpretations here concerning the context here of public worship. We'll talk about the praying and the prophesying. We'll relate what Paul says here, giving the woman the right to pray and to prophesy in this context, but other places he tells the women to be silent in church. We'll try to relate that together see that if we define our terms properly and put them in the context, that we have no contradiction in any of the revelation. All right, so interesting chapter. It's one that we all perhaps will not see eye to eye on, but we don't on prophecy either, so, you know, whatever. We have our arguments and our different opinion on most everything. So, my class, so I give you my view. All right, we'll close in prayer. David Stair, would you close us in prayer?